CliffCentral.com.
Right, going to get into some news, see what's happening in the world. Leanne Moll has got some headlines for us. I'll check in on those. And you can get hold of us on 0797482090. Hope you're ready for another good week and lots of things happening.
After actually a very positive weekend.
I think so. I mean, people are still on a little bit of a high from, you know, that couple that got engaged in the KFC.
Oh.
People still on a high from the rugby. So, you know what? Oh. Let people have their fun. Why must we come out of our euphoria and hit the world of the ugly, harsh world of reality now? We're having too much fun.
Did you see the development of the KFC proposal story over the weekend?
Yeah, there have been people offering all kinds. See, Black Coffee said he would like sponsor the outfits for the...
Yo, so there's this, in particular,
party or something, right?
There's Sibu Mabena on Twitter, who I discovered this weekend because she started keeping a spreadsheet of all of these people who are offering things. I love it. Like, you know, everyone's banding together saying, we'll give you cash for this and we'll give you cows and we'll give you champagne. And so the... like several spreadsheets of what people have been offering. So yeah, like Kanyim Bao said she would MC the wedding. Austin Malema, who's a famous photographer, said that he would take photos at the wedding.
Right.
A bank stepped in and said that they would give the couple 300,000 rands. It even got like global attention because like the Washington Post wrote about it over the weekend.
Wow.
Lonnie Love is a comedian based in the States. She says, I love South Africa so much, I'm volunteering to be a flower girl at the wedding.
That's fantastic.
The singer Jadena said that he'll be doing a concert here in South Africa actually and would like to give the couple VIP access should they want to. DJ Sbu donated his MoFire. Precious the Plan is a famous wedding plan and said she would put the wedding together. This is like
amazing.
Major.
Wow.
And that's, you know, great. How OPW is a big thing in South Africa.
Yes.
So now Mzansi Magic has also said, do you guys want a wedding special? And we'll put together a wedding
it
special
must be
for
so
you.
Overwhelming for them.
Is,
I mean,
so
she,
crazy.
She was covering her face out of like embarrassment and what. Emotion, rather, when she was proposed to. So she's obviously quite a shy person.
Can just to have the people in the restaurant looking at the...
Yeah, it's such a nice, happy story. And you know what? It shows you that there are some people in all the ugliness of social media, because it is overwhelmingly an awful place. It shows you there are good people out there, and they do want to do good things, and they like celebrating other human beings.
Mm. Mm-hmm. So we now actually know more about the couple. Their name is Hector Mkansi and Nonhlanhla Soldat. They've been together since 2010. And they actually had some sort of a wedding. This part is the part that's not clear for me. But they had some sort of a wedding back in 2012. And now I think maybe this is like their white wedding as opposed to their traditional wedding. But now they're having the celebration again.
Sure. Mm. Okay. Well, apparently Chad Leclos tweeted he was proud to have won gold, and then someone responded and asked if he'd swim at the wedding. There's a lot going on there.
What I also like is, you know, Twitter sometimes really is horrible. There were some people who were volunteering their services. So there's this amateur photographer who had said like, hey guys, here are some of the photos I've taken. I'd like to volunteer my services. And people are like, thank you. No, thanks.
Oh, shame that you could ruin the photographer.
Yes.
You know, you could ruin your whole reputation.
Even just like startup fashion designers are like, we will make you garments. And people are like, no. And then probably tag like David Tlale instead.
Wow. Okay. Apparently, this is just a correction on something that Salehu and I were talking about earlier from Oki. He says, according to Reuters, Alibaba raked in an incredible $19 billion in sales within the first hour of Singles Day.
Oh.
That's a 32% jump from last year. That's just in the first hour, not the first day. 19 billion. That's unbelievable.
Mm.
And here, Leanne, is an interesting place that you might want to go to. It's called Hasingdan Park. It's a park filled with huge penis statues, and it's in South Korea. It's just penises everywhere.
Wow.
So if you want to go there,
like to have like a bachelorette party there. You don't need the penis straws or anything like
no,
that.
No. Oh, wow. All right. Very good. So what's going on?
Oh, but just last thing on some of the weekend's developments.
Yes.
People had, which I thought was so insensitive, Entlen Bailey, Black Coffee's wife and the actress, amongst other things, she, in vague words, confirmed that they're now officially getting a divorce, she and Black Coffee yesterday.
Oh, no, I'm sorry.
And as much as this is a sensitive issue and it's a personal matter, people were saying, look, South Africa's having good times right now. We don't need your news.
Oh, my word.
We're winning World Cups. We're planning weddings. We're celebrating things. Please, could you not have waited just like couple more days right now?
I'm sorry for them. But, yeah, you know, that must suck hugely. It just shows you. You always look at people and you go, well, these people must be having the best life ever. They've got money. They've got, you know, in Black Coffee's case, fame. She's beautiful. Mm. It's just, you think they can't have problems. Mm. They do.
They announced about 3 or 4 months ago that they were separated.
Yeah.
Well, I think part of what is just dragging this whole process along is neither of them have been very straightforward with what is happening. And look, they don't owe the public an explanation, but sometimes keeping quiet just adds fuel to the fire because they've said things in the past like, you know, we are going through something in our marriage that is between us. That instantly gets people going and speculating. Mm. Should they have said from the get-go, we are currently separated and that is all we want to say right now, then, you know, the speculation and the conversation probably would have died down. But even with what Entler posted yesterday, she posted a video on her Instagram and was like, a selfie video in black and white already, that's just too theatrical for everything. And then she was mincing her words and just skirting around the issues. Just sit on top of it, say, this is what is happening and this is all I'm going to say and don't ask me anything else.
Yeah. Look, it's none of our business how they decide to handle it and it's nobody else's business what they're doing.
Yeah.
You guys go for it. You do your thing. Mm-hmm. Sometimes relationships don't last forever.
Yeah, exactly. Also a bit of sad news from the Kruger Park. But the way the story is written, right? Mm-hmm. See if you can pick up why it's making me angry.
Go on.
Right, the
headline is 4 injured as giraffe causes Kruger Park accident.
4 injured as giraffe causes Kruger Park accident.
Okay, so that's the headline. So we start looking at...
You almost think like this giraffe would have run in and started kicking people's cars and...
Yeah.
But that's obviously not what happened, right?
No. So...
Okay. Help me understand.
A combi with 13 day visitors... was traveling along and a giraffe stepped into the road.
Mm-hmm.
The taxi couldn't avoid hitting it.
Oh, God.
And they hit the giraffe and the giraffe fell onto another vehicle, a rented safari vehicle.
Oh, my God.
And the driver of that vehicle, the Swiss national, was seriously injured and a passenger suffered minor injuries and he had to actually be airlifted to hospital. And the giraffe died instantly.
Yeah, poor animal.
So to me, the headline should be giraffe struck by speeding combi.
Yeah, right.
In the Kruger Park.
Dumb human causes accident with giraffe in its territory. I agree with you. That's the way to do it.
I mean, what?
Jesus.
4 paragraphs down, the giraffe died on impact.
Yeah, but you see, this is it. There's going to be a day in the future where people are going to look at the way that human beings... their attitude, our attitude to animals. And they're going to say, this is ridiculous and it's embarrassing and I can't believe people ever behaved like that. Right?
Damn.
Stupid.
Stupid story.
And today's Armistice Day, the 11th of the 11th. That's why if you see anything that's going on in Britain at the moment, everyone's wearing poppies.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that it feels like a million years ago, but it's just over 100 years ago that... that World War I ended. And Armistice Day is when all the guns fell silent. And it's quite an important thing for us to commemorate because it changed the world. Not just Europe, the world.
Mm.
So quite a big deal.
That's huge. Well, speaking of the world wars, an American submarine of World War II has been found only now. 75 years later.
Tell me.
Off Okinawa in Japan, well, in Japanese water. So private explorers have found this submarine. It was called the USS Greyback, beneath 1,400 feet of water, after realizing that a mistranslated Japanese war record had pointed searchers in the wrong direction.
Hmm.
So it's been hidden all this
mysterious
time by a single errant digit.
Oh, really?
The mystery began January the 28th, 1944, when the Greyback, which was one of the most successful American submarines of World War II, sailed out of Pearl Harbor for its 10th combat patrol.
Mm-hmm.
By late March, it was more than 3 weeks overdue to return, and the Navy listed the submarine as missing and presumed lost.
Okay.
They tried searching, but all were given approximate locations, and still they couldn't find it. The Navy had unknowingly relied on a flawed translation of Japanese war records that got one digit wrong in the latitude and longitude of the spot where the Greyback had probably met its end.
Sure.
And now just an amateur researcher was going through these records and found that this was the issue, and hence it's been found by this salvage company.
I bet you they would have found it a lot earlier if it was carrying gold.
Yeah, I suppose
you bet
so.
Someone would have dug around and found that thing.
Wow. Okay.
Very nice. Exciting stuff. New discoveries in sunken ships and submarines.
Yes.
All right. What else is going on?
Well, you literally need to feel happy to be alive.
Tell
when
me
you
why.
Read the story.
Uh-oh.
A Texas woman was just this month declared dead while she was still alive.
You said this is a happy story.
No.
It's not starting
off that well. She was actually alive. She's alive, but she's officially
been declared
dead. So why did
they declare her dead? Why?
Apparently it happens Idiots. Quite often in the US when there are mistakes in the Social Security Administration.
Yeah?
they say, in 2016 there were fewer than 1,000 cases of mistaken deaths declared a month.
Okay, so, but if you're wandering around and you're alive, how can they declare you dead?
They just do. There's some administration glitch.
Oh, boy. So does she stop paying taxes?
Well, the thing is...
Oh, there are perks to this situation.
Not in her case, Shane. Yeah. She's 73 years old, and she was picking up her prescription from Walgreens when her bank card was declined.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
And she knew something was fishy because the card was only 3 months old and it had money in it. And after a round of phone calls to the bank, she found out she'd been declared dead by the Social Security Administration.
That is awkward.
So she can't get gas. She can't get money for food. She can't do anything. Her medication, she can't get. She's on like a lot of chronic medication. So apparently Medicare, her medical aid, can't even do anything until the Social Security Administration resurrects
Listen,
her.
Imagine the nightmare of being declared dead in this country and having to go to Home Affairs and explain that you're not dead because you know
here I am.
Yeah, I'm not dead. Excuse me, ma'am, please just wait your turn. But I'm not dead. I really need to be declared not dead so that I can open up a bank account. You can imagine at the counter here at Home Affairs they'd be like, prove you're not dead. What?
Well, look, you've heard of the cases, though, of people who are married, according to Home Affairs. And it's like, no, I do not know who this person is. And it's mistaken identity.
For sure.
So now that you're declared dead, this hinders your whole life.
Hugely. But you know what's interesting? I know of two cases, both very close to me,
mm-hmm.
Of someone who died. And to try and cease their cell phone contract is nearly impossible.
Mm-hmm. And the other one that you can't get them to stop sending you is your SABC TV license when someone dies. I know somebody whose their mother died, I don't know, 8 years ago. They're still getting demands from the SABC.
Seriously?
To settle her SABC TV license. She's like, she's been dead 8 years. Good luck. And they just will not, they don't get the message.
Relentless.
Yeah.
Wow.
You have to send them a death certificate or something, and then they might. But, I mean, imagine going to that much trouble.
Mm. Well, talking about death just reminds me of the story I sent you guys over the weekend, and I still think
Yeah.
I think this guy has a fighting chance. Yes. I am so behind him with this.
Go on.
Oh, yes.
The prisoner, Benjamin Schreiber, who now is very much alive, but he hasn't stopped arguing that he died 4 years ago. So Benjamin Schreiber is a convicted murderer, and he's in prison for life. Back in 2015, though, he collapsed in his prison cell, mm-hmm. and doctors started to resuscitate him, and they restarted his heart 5 times. Technically, let's work on technicalities, ladies and gentlemen.
All right, so he's in.
He was dead.
All right, but he's in jail, and he's been declared dead.
And then he was resuscitated.
Resuscitated. So he goes to the panel of judges, and he says, "Listen, guys, I pretty much died, and I died in prison. I managed to somehow make it through. Can we just write off what I've still got to do in terms of jail time?
That means I've served my life sentence.
Right. Yes.
Yeah, let me out.
He served his life sentence.
What did they say?
No, the judges aren't buying it. Okay. They said dying for a brief amount of time doesn't amount to a get out of free card. This is what the Iowa Court of Appeals ruled last weekend. So they're saying that the 66-year-old will have to remain in prison until a medical examiner determines that he's dead for good.
Sure.
Poor Benjamin.
Nice
poor
try.
Guy. He was doing so well.
Benjamin, I'm here for you, though. I think you must fight this further.
You know, if you could be declared...
Do you know what he did?
Yes. Oh, it is. Oh, do you want to hear what he did?
Is he a horrible person?
He's been behind bars since 1996 when he was charged in the death of a John Dale Terry, who was 39 years old at the time. He killed John Dale Terry.
Yeah.
And hid his body in an abandoned trailer.
So he's a wholesome dude, this.
Yeah, he clubbed the man to death with a wooden handle of a pickaxe.
Wow.
Yeah.
It's a lot of anger to kill someone like that.
So a jury found him guilty of first-degree murder, and in 1997, he was sentenced to life without parole.
Jeez.
But, I mean, he technically died. Oh. He served his time. I think he must keep the good fight going here.
Yeah, listen. If you're declared technically dead, you should just write a book, and you could tell everybody what it looks like on the other side,
and no one can dispute it. Actually,
no one can. What are they going to do?
Yeah, how else can we prove? Because none of us have died yet.
Yeah, right. So you write a book and you tell everyone you've seen the other side, and this is what it is, and this is what happens, and then you were sent back by God because he said, "I'm not finished with you yet. You have much more to do."
You know you're giving Benjamin some ideas now.
Sure, do it, dude. Go and write your book. Make some serious money out of that because, you know, gullible idiots all over the world will fall for it like you cannot believe. Desperately hoping that that's all true, that there's a life after this.
Mm.
Go on, write your book.
At least have something to do in prison.
All right. In other news, this is quite an interesting story. So Leanne tipped me off about this.
Mm-hmm.
Apparently, a Porsche launched into a New Jersey building's second floor, leaving 2 dead. How does this happen? I saw a...
Wow.
I saw a picture of a... You know these fancy... these garages that lift and lower your car into like a basement parking or whatever.
Yeah.
So one of these has malfunctioned and it squashed this G-Wagon between...
Oh no, it sandwiched it.
Sandwiched it between like the concrete platform, I suppose, and the actual thing that moves up and down the lift.
Yeah.
Effectively. So this thing was squashed.
Hopefully like no one was inside it.
I don't think so, no. I think it was while it was being parked. But what a disaster.
Imagine the terror if you were inside there. Wow.
What
it's like a really slow death.
Yeah, because you... that's pretty horrible.
Yeah.
I didn't think about it that way. I hope there was no one in the car.
I'd rather be in this accident if I was to compare the way of dying.
Go on.
But it was a 22-year-old and 23-year-old set of friends. And they launched this Porsche at high speed after hitting a pavement.
Yeah.
They launched this Porsche into the second floor of this office park. They both were pronounced dead on the scene.
Jesus, they went through
and
the wall.
It happened at around 6:30 a.m. So it could only have been from partying the night before, surely.
Oh, wow. But if you see the picture, they've actually gone into nose first,
Yes.
Into the top of a brick building.
Through the second floor.
It's a house, right?
It's an office house.
Oh, okay, okay.
Yeah, it's like an
looks
office.
Like a house.
So obviously no one was in there at the time because it's an office. Thank goodness. But the first responders just cordoned off the area and they're trying to figure out how this happened. But I mean, can you imagine having seen that happen? It would have been crazy.
Dreadful.
It's left this huge gaping hole in this office house.
People are so stupid and they do such stupid things. I don't understand how in a day and age where we've got Uber, why you would want to drive, especially if you own a Porsche, for heaven's sake.
Mm.
You know, these people could still be alive. Their Porsche would still be safely in the garage and they could have paid someone to drive them around.
Yeah.
Right now, you don't need to ever drive drunk. It's crazy. I see these accidents sometimes when I'm on my way home late at night and I see other people had these horrible accidents on the road. And I think, you know, you probably could have saved yourself.
Mm.
And obviously, I'm hoping that nobody died. But even if they were just injured, you could save yourself from that as well.
Yeah.
So unnecessary.
Not great.
So unnecessary. Not today. Here's something interesting. We were talking about this earlier, and this is maybe something that a lot of people are going through right now. This is from Natasha. She says, on the earlier topic of looks, because everybody's talking about their summer bodies and how none of us have them, right?
Yeah.
Natasha says, I'm someone who finds intelligence and the human mind to be more sexually attractive than appearance. Looks fade. All right. Well, yeah, I suppose you're right, Natasha, but I'm like most people, I'm superficial.
You know, earlier I said you would need to send me a photo.
Yes, because we were trying to find Leanne.
It's not because I'm shallow. And I'm not checking if you're good looking. It's just I can tell from a person's looks a lot. I can tell whether I would be able to get on with them or not.
Really?
Yeah.
I couldn't. I'm just superficial. I just want to see if they're good looking. A slim, blonde, blue-eyed friend had her new passport issued with a photo of a large bearded Indian man alongside all her accurate details. Home Affairs response, prove it's not you. It took 8 months and a lawyer to resolve it.
Oh, my word.
That's unbelievable. It's from Morgan. Isn't that amazing?
A friend of mine had her ID photo taken for her driver's license card. And in the photo, she happened to look up to the ceiling, but a little to the right. So, and they've accepted the photograph. So on her ID, she's looking out the top corner of her eyes.
And they accepted it.
Yes.
That's because they're very strict about those photographs sometimes, especially with
that's
visas.
That's what I thought.
Yeah. Apparently in the north of Australia, they've got, they're also going to their trouble of celebrating Armistice Day. But how can you tell a Territorian has won the lotto? Territorian is the north of Australia, right?
Mm-hmm.
Northern Territories. Mm-hmm. They call them Territorians. How could you tell if they won the lotto? They've air-conditioned their tent.
Oh, yeah.
Because they all just live in those. They call them swags. All right, so there we go. Some North Australian humor for the morning.
Yes.
So is Natasha saying that you can indeed bang a personality? I suppose you could. Look, some people are turned on by that kind of thing, you know?
Mm.
All right, very good. What else is going on?
Miley Cyrus is recovering from vocal cord surgery.
That's not good.
Mm-mm.
She's a singer. What did she have? Was there something wrong with them? Did she have a cancerous growth on them or something?
She's known for a while that she needed surgery on her vocal cords.
Yeah.
And recently she just had tonsillitis and went into hospital for that. And they reminded her that she needs to have this operation. So she has done that, and she's now in a new relationship after her and what's his name got divorced.
Hemsworth.
Yes, thank you.
Are they divorced already?
Yeah, her new boyfriend is an Australian singer. He's 4 years her junior.
Yeah,
they look very happy together. His name is Cody Simpson, and the two of them are just waiting out her rest. She's doing physical exercises, etc., but she is not allowed to use her vocal cords for a few weeks.
So she can't talk?
Cannot talk. She's totally silent.
Can't talk at all?
No. she, otherwise
Imagine
it's
how
going,
annoying that is. I would not last very long. Does she write stuff on a scrap of paper and then?
Must do. I remember losing my voice for 6 weeks.
Yeah.
I don't know if you remember.
I do remember that. Yeah. It's terrifying.
And I actually, just something small like going to order your medication or go to the shops or whatever. Mm-hmm. The frustration. I remember being in tears because of it. It was just so annoying.
Do you think that technology has helped if people can't talk, for example, or they've just had vocal surgery like she did? You think that being able to text people is possibly a good alternative?
Well, I mean, you've got like, you can use your iPad as like an Etch-a-Sketcher, or you can use an actual Etch-a-Sketcher, which isn't technology at all.
Yeah.
But yeah, I'm sure sitting without in the days before we had cell phones would have been quite torturous.
Here's an interesting, you know, I love these lists, right?
Yes.
Where they break things down. So the share of world total of extreme poverty has been tabulated. In other words,
share
per country,
okay, yes.
Which countries contribute the most to world poverty?
Yeah.
Right? So South Africa is 2.3%. So we are responsible for 2.3% of the extreme poverty in the world.
Okay.
So that's not so bad. Indonesia is at 2.1. Bangladesh is the same as us.
Ooh.
Tanzania is at 3. Ethiopia is at 4.6. India at 8% of extreme poverty. Congo contributes 10% of that number. And the highest on the list is Nigeria. 15.7%.
Wow.
Of the extreme poverty in the world is in Nigeria. And then it goes down to, you know, less large offenders like Pakistan, the US, and Mexico at 0.3%.
Yeah.
But we contribute 2.3% of the extreme poverty in the world. That's quite
scary.
Well,
what shocks me is that we're on almost a par with countries like Bangladesh.
Yeah. Bangladesh is some serious poverty there.
Mm.
Just shows you.
Sure.
Oh, you're horrified.
I am.
All right. The year might be winding down, but if your body needs a little help getting into the festive spirit, check out the latest Skin Sense Day Spa specials at cliffcentral.com. Why? Well, because they offer a comprehensive range of expert beauty treatments for women and men, including massages, manicures, pedicures, hair treatments, and a whole lot more. Get at cliffcentral.com immediately and find out more at skinsense.co.za, where you can also book treatments and even shop online.
Mm-hmm.
Feel you need that just before the holidays?
Oh.
Do it, do it, do it.
Very good.
Get yourself in tip-top condition.
Mm.
Look good, feel good. All right, here's something interesting. I am a deceased person on Home Affairs' system. This is from El Marais. She says, through my passport lady, I managed to get a new passport and ID issued. After that, they changed my status back to deceased. I now have to try and change it back to alive with Home Affairs.
How is she even functioning?
Disaster, right?
I have so many questions. Because are you allowed to... So you might have a job. Where does your salary go? Do you have a bank account?
Yeah.
What happens to your bond? What happens to your cars?
Medical aid insurance.
Yeah, imagine you get checked into a hospital and they go, well, this person's just dead on arrival. But you're actually just going for a tonsillitis check or something.
You could live an online life.
Yeah.
Like, Tinder's not going to know that you're dead.
Look, yeah, Leanne, I'm talking about your money to survive.
Are you talking,
I'm talking about
like
job.
Literal life and death.
Yes, important things than just online dating. Oh, I'm dead. Let me just carry
on
swiping
says,
left and right.
On the Miley Cyrus story, can we call her Miley Silent?
Yes.
That's from Sivan. Nice one. All right, very good. We got to get Candace Mama in here. I want to talk to her about her book. She's written a book called Forgiveness Redefined, A Young Woman's Journey Towards Forgiving the Apartheid Assassin Who Brutally Murdered Her Father. And she says that she is a forgiveness advocate and a happiness activist. So I think that
sounds like the way to go.
Yeah, I like that. I'm going to maybe steal those and put them on my list
on
of
your
things.
Biog.
I'm going to say I'm a happiness activist. How are you, Candace Mama? Good to
you,
see
Gareth
you.
Gareth Cliff.
By the way, you're looking very glamorous.
Oh, thank you so much. Oh. This is what happens when you get ready at 4 in the morning. I actually don't know what I look like.
Well, I'm so impressed. You look great.
Thank you.
All right, so
thank you.
Congratulations on the book. The last time I saw you, you were still doing shows here with us.
I was.
You've been busy, huh?
Somewhat. Yeah. I think, you know, once I left here, I was like, what am I going to do with my life, my time? I'm unemployed.
Yeah, I mean,
it's all over.
Yeah, it's right. All over for me.
So I'm amazed. Like, this is a very, very insightful book. And first of all, I mean, I continue to be inspired by people who managed to find a way of making really difficult things in their past an element of how they go forward and what they can do for other people. But you've always been so optimistic, and you know, you really are a bundle of energy. You come in, aww, here and you bounce around, you smile, you make everybody happy around you. And just, we've got to go to the start of this story, because okay, I don't think a lot of people even know necessarily what happened when you were a little girl and what happened to your dad.
Yeah.
And maybe we should start with that, because that's where the book begins.
Yeah, absolutely. So when I was 7 months, I used to say 9 months, but my maths is really bad. Oh. So when I was 7 months, my father was brutally murdered by an apartheid assassin by the name of Eugene de Kock.
Eugene de Kock is famously still in prison in Pretoria.
No, he's actually gone on parole.
Is he on parole?
Yeah.
Now? Oh, yes,
yeah.
Of course. Sorry, that, yes, was a, that was a while ago. Yeah.
Yes, yes. And
right.
I think he's living on the outskirts of Pretoria somewhere. Yeah, so he murdered my father.
This is the guy who used to run Flukplaas, right?
Yes.
That,
yes,
was that farm that the old apartheid government kept, where they would interrogate apartheid activists, and mm-hmm, some of these people would just never be found.
Yes.
They would, yeah, be buried in shallow graves. Some of them have still never been found.
Mm-hmm.
And their families that have just never had closure.
Mm.
But you're at 7 months old at this point.
Yeah.
You don't know what's going on.
I mean,
on.
There's no comprehension,
sure,
right?
Sure, of course. But your mother...
Yes, yes, the rest of my family. And I think for me, what I wanted to do with the book was not necessarily just focus on, you know, my dad's death, but to show really the impact and the ripple effect that it has on a family when someone gets ripped away in such a brutal way, and how that trauma continues to kind of just ripple through the seams of a family and how they interact with one another and how they interact with life.
Mm. Where do you start, though? Because even though you didn't really know your dad, this effect, as you say, that ripples through the whole family. This is something that you've had to grow up with, that you've had to endure as much as everybody else has.
So
where do you even start to develop? Because I would just be furious and I would just be angry, and I don't know that I'd ever be able to get over that.
Yeah.
How do you feel about where it all starts?
You know, I mean, I was incredibly angry and I was incredibly depressed, and just, you know, I wanted the world to feel what I felt. So I wanted the world to feel this anger and pain and resentment. And I was like, if I can't be happy, why should anyone else be? So that was my state of being for
so
a
like
very long
resentment
time.
Resentment.
Absolutely.
And bitterness.
Absolutely.
And, sure.
And I think for me, what I came to find was, you know, when you go through painful events in life, any sort of event, the world will justify your pain. Like, they'll be like, yeah, you know, you're entitled to feel angry because this is what happened to you. But for me, I had a very awakening moment, if you could say that.
Sure.
I think I was around 16 when I thought I was having a heart attack, went to the hospital, and the doctor pretty much told me my body was killing me. And so
stress.
It was ulcers. It was like depression. He was just like, I don't know what the hell's happening with you, but you're too young to be manifesting these kind of symptoms in your body. And I mean, I was an athlete and I ate relatively well. So I was very confused, but I was never confused about where it came from. I kind of knew that the anger and the resentment was kind of manifesting physically, even though I couldn't scientifically prove it. I just knew that my body was not necessarily keeping up with what was happening in my mind. So for me, I had to decide, what am I going to do?
So that pain and that resentment that was growing in you and that was manifesting itself physically in these symptoms. So you were getting depressed, but you were also getting ulcers and all these kinds of things. So it actually has... There's a mind-body connection there. That
absolutely. Like if you look at certain cancers, they're created from stressful moments, from shockingly traumatic stressful moments. And it's your cells have a memory, and it actually remembers that trauma, that mental trauma that you've been through.
Hmm. How do you break out of that, though?
It's not easy. It's, you know, it's for me, it was a two-part thing. So number one, it was like, do I want to break out of this? Because
for some people, it sustains them. It's all they've got, right? Their pain.
Exactly. And I also thought to myself, like, if I die, would it be that bad? You know, so to me, it wasn't about like, do I want to survive? It was just like, which is kind of the easiest way here. Like, do I just die?
Oh,
and
really?
Like, you know, and I cease to exist. And, you know, I start over if there's reincarnation, or I just float into the abyss if, you know, there's no other life. Or do I decide to attempt to live? And for me, it was just the wanting to attempt. It was never a full in, I'm going to try and do this. It was just, let me try. Let me see how it would work if I did try to love. And then it became anger at Eugene. So it was kind of like, you know, I'm so angry at him. Why am I letting him control me like this? Like, F him kind of thing. So it didn't necessarily start as forgiveness. It started as like, why am I giving him this power over me? And that's when my journey really started. And I started thinking differently around my situation.
Whose stories gave you some kind of a template in this respect? Because you're a young woman at this stage, 16 years old.
Yeah.
You don't know. You need to find examples of other people who've had to deal with forgiveness or have had to deal with letting go of their pain.
Yeah.
Who inspired you at that point?
I mean, luckily living in South Africa, right? There's like just everywhere people are giving you stories of pretty much forgiveness, letting go, moving forward. I mean, Archbishop, former President Nelson Mandela. And so there were so many examples of it. But for me, it didn't necessarily resonate, to be honest, because I thought to myself, like, how? Like, yeah. You know, and I genuinely thought like, Desmond Tutu and Nelson Mandela were like birthed by angels. I was like, I don't have that capacity to forgive. Like, who am I? You know, so it didn't necessarily, I didn't even think about forgiveness. For me, it was just, let me attempt to be happy. Let me start a life where I can feel fulfillment in some sort of way. And let me move in that way. And as I started moving forward, I started thinking, okay, maybe it's not a bad thing if I let go. And for me, letting go meant, let me understand the context of what is happening and what has happened. And for me, that really started my journey to forgiveness.
All right. But then you did something extraordinary because you wanted to meet Eugene de Kock.
Yeah.
You're like, I'm going to meet this son of a bitch who killed my dad, effectively.
Yeah.
That's horrible.
Mm.
Because you have to face your fears.
Oh, yeah.
Who initiated that?
Huh? So that was the National Prosecuting Authorities that actually initiated the meeting. And I have to be honest, like, I mean, I met Eugene, I'm now 28, I met him around 4 years ago. And I never thought this would happen. Like, you know, even when I was 16 and 17 and 18, and I was working through these moments of pain and I was trying to forgive him, I never thought there'd be a face-to-face encounter. I thought like, you know, I'm just going to forgive him, move on with my life, and that's it. And so when I was forced to face him, that's where the challenge came in. Because it's one thing to say, yeah, I forgive you. It's another thing to sit in front of someone and say, do I forgive you though? You know, so I was kind of more afraid of my own response to him, you know, and was that going to set me back in what I thought was a progressive journey of healing.
Where does this meeting happen?
So it happened at Kgosi Mampura Prison in Pretoria.
Okay. It's before he was released. So you go there and do you think about what you're going to wear? I know this sounds ridiculous, but like,
no.
You're going to face your dad's killer after a life that's been defined by this. You know, you're going to sit and look at this son of a bitch, but you've got to now, you got to think about what did you consider, were you on maybe some kind of tranquilizer or something?
I mean, firstly, those are really great questions because you'd actually, like, I mean, thinking back, I've never even asked myself those questions. Like, what did I think of what I was going to
wear? If they made a movie of your life, you know, like, this would be a scene in the movie.
Yeah, absolutely.
And people would go, what should we make her wear? What would
Well, there's a picture of what I was wearing and it looked awful. So clearly I didn't think of what I was going to wear. If I knew, I would have dressed better. But no, I wasn't on anything. But I think there was this odd calmness. There was like a, because I don't think I fully comprehended what was going to happen, you know. So my body kind of just went into like this autopilot mode and just going through the motions of what was happening. And I mean, I come from a family who I speak about in my book where we don't speak about emotions. Emotions aren't a thing in my family, you know. We would rather have a root canal treatment without anesthetic than speak about emotions, right? So we make light of everything. And so like all of us are like, yeah, I'm not going to be the first one to crack kind of thing. And so we didn't really comprehend it until actually the moment just before we saw him. So I think that's when it really hit me. Like when we were all sitting down, you know, we'd had coffee because they were briefing us on what was going to happen.
How many of you are there?
So it was myself, my older brother, my younger brother from my stepdad, and my mom and my grandfather, my dad's dad. Yeah. Wow. So yeah, so it was us, and then there were other people from the prison, you know, the priest, and the warden of the prison. And
okay, so the door goes clang, and someone walks through.
No, so it wasn't actually. It was actually like, because I was expecting that. I thought I was going to see like a proper prison inside. Nothing like that. It was actually like you're visiting someone, like you're visiting like an old relative or something with a long dining room table, and like this odd urn in the corner with biscuits. It was like a very odd setup, which I think added to the eerie feeling, because you're kind of like, what is happening? Like, I'm not visiting family here, you know? So you kind of get that feeling. But then there's like a door, there are two separate doors. And I thought, like, you know, I don't know what I expected. Like, you know, what does one expect when you go and meet someone who's responsible for so many deaths and murders? And so I was like, okay, obviously.
Did they let you choose? Do you want to go behind door number one or door number two?
I wish they had. No, so for us, they were like, oh, he's going to walk in at any minute, you know, and it will take off. But if you ever feel uncomfortable, blah, blah, blah. So when they said that, I thought they were still going to introduce him. Like, yeah. Hey, guys, Eugene's walking in now. Like, you know, don't be alarmed. No, they didn't do that. So like, I think because he was the closest to me. And I turned around first, and he was just sitting there, like he had just appeared like a ghost.
Oh my word.
And I was like, whoa, 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 whoa. How did he, is there like a locked door at the bottom of the floor? And he just like,
but you
rises.
Knew what he looked like from pictures and things.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And he did not, like, he didn't look any different. It's like prison preserved him. It was the oddest sight. Yeah, so he was just sitting there. He had, they'd taken off his like cuffs and stuff. And he was obviously in this orange jumpsuit with his glasses. And so when I saw him, the priest who was sitting next to me was like, oh, okay, yeah, maybe I should say something. And I was like, maybe you should. And then he started introducing Eugene and, you know, to each and every one of us. And he was like, you know, that's Sandra Mama, wife of the deceased Glenok Masilo Mama, and then my grandfather, blah, blah, blah. And he introduced us individually. And with each one of us, Eugene would lean forward and say, pleasure to meet you, then sit back. Pleasure to meet you, then sit back. And, you know, so it kind of went like that. And I mean, it was still very uncomfortable.
Jeez.
Like, I don't think I took a breath once during that like initial greeting. Yeah. And did
was it just your family that he did this with? Did he do it with all of the families?
No, so it was actually a victim perpetrator dialogue. So apparently they'd been looking for the different families, you know, who, like, I mean, I don't know how they were going to find all, you know, 212 victims, or, but they were looking for families and they were doing these dialogues. So I think they'd met, I'm not 100% sure, but I think it was like over 20 families at that time. And we were like coming towards the end, the close of it, because apparently they couldn't find us, which is weird because my mom was so active on Facebook. So they clearly weren't looking, but yeah.
So for him, it had become a little bit routine by this stage.
Yeah, I would assume so. And I think, I mean, it was a meeting that, you know, you expect an outcome from, I think, in some ways. You expect him to be a certain way. And I think for me, maybe it came from practice. I don't know. But he wasn't what I had expected him to be, you know, which
explain that to me, because what was he like then? Now, this is a guy who's got to try and apologize to you.
Yeah.
And to try and carry across with some sincerity the fact that he ruined all of your lives.
Yeah, pretty much. And so for me, I wasn't expecting, I don't want to say warmth, because there was still a coldness in the room, but there was definitely, I don't know, like a palpable, like, you know, you could feel kind of the remorse he was feeling, you know. It was like he really wanted us to get as much closure as possible, and he understood that there's nothing he can do really, right? Like, unless he could resurrect my dad, there's really nothing he can do for us. And so he was trying so hard to, like, almost, and he has a photographic memory, and so he just knew every single detail. He knew exactly my dad's case. He knew exactly what happened. He, like, retold that story as if it happened yesterday.
Well, he must have been going through it in his head for years in jail. He's had nothing else to do.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Did it make you feel, when you walked out, exhausted? Or
uplifted?
Yeah. Did you feel a little bit lighter, or did you just feel drained?
Oh, I felt completely conflicted, actually. Because in that moment, so the encounter comes to conclusion and it ends. And so I stand up first, and it was so emotional because I'd already been crying, and, you know, and from what he had told me about his life. And so I get up first and I go to him and I'm like, would you mind if I gave you a hug? And so I hug this man, and then he says to me, I'm so sorry for what I've done, and your father would have been so proud of the woman you've become. And I'm like, So I mean, I was just like, what is happening? What is happening right now? And so I felt this sadness for him, because I was like, there's nothing, like, even if I say I forgive you, there's nothing that can remotely affect your life from this point forward. You know,
like, life's horrible. What life? I mean,
there is no life, right?
There's no life left there.
And so for me, I was like, oh my gosh, you know, like, am I betraying my dad's memory, or am I, you know, like, I was a little conflicted, like, driving back home, like, I just embraced the guy who killed my dad, you know, how does this work, you know? And so I felt,
but there's no right or wrong at that moment, right? It's only what you, Candace, feel, and you can respond whichever way you like, and it's right.
Absolutely.
Just unbelievable.
Yeah.
So what I love about the book is you kind of, it's your story, but you're also, there are lots of things in here that are useful tips for people who are struggling to forgive and to move on and to relinquish that feeling of being a prisoner of your own pain. And I think that's really beautiful. Is that one of the purposes you had in mind when you wrote it?
Wow, that makes me happy.
It's not just you telling your story. Yeah.
Yeah, that makes me really happy to hear. Yeah, you know, a big part, like, I had no intention of, you know, doing this as a career, speaking about forgiveness, writing a book about it. And I think for me, once I began sharing my story, you know, it started these small, like, you know, or crowds, and every single time I tell my story, like, no less than 5 people would come up to me and reveal, like, some of the deepest, darkest, you know, secrets, and say, I've never told anyone, and you sharing your story gives me the power to share my own. And I was like, oh, you know, so many people need healing, but how do I do it in a way that I don't physically necessarily have to be there, but they can have something that is, you know, my story, and that can give them guidance and help just by reading what I've been through.
I mean, you've been so honest about it. So here we go. First thing you do when you find out that your body's really not responding well to you, and you're sending yourself to an early grave.
Yeah.
You list the pros and cons of living and dying. I mean, I love this, because this is what a lot of people think in their head.
That's what people actually do.
Right. So she goes, well, pros, I won't feel pain anymore.
Yeah.
I won't exist. I'll finally know the meaning of life. I can float around haunting people. I'll find out if there's a heaven or a hell. Wait a minute. Do I go to hell if I just let myself die? Or is it only when I kill myself? And does hell exist if you don't believe in Christianity? And finally, you're losing track. Focus. Then she lists the cons. Like, if she kills herself, she'll stop existing. She'll never know love. She'll never have children. She'll never see the world. My brothers and family will miss me. The thing is, death messes up the people left behind more than me. If I move on and go to another plane or just disappear, will it change my family, possibly for the worst? Who will be the mediator? And if I die, I would never have experienced happiness. Oof. So you list these things, and turns out they're more cons than pros.
Here I am.
And you decided to stay alive. No, I mean, you know, this is a hard thing to write
but
down.
But also for someone you mentioned a little bit earlier that emotion is not dealt with in a regular manner in your family.
Yeah.
For someone coming from that, You seem very in touch with your emotions, and the way you're able to explain them is extraordinary.
Oh, thank you. Thank you so much. And I think I've probably, like, you know, the same way I understood that when I was angry, I had this aura that I wanted to hurt other people, is the same way when I found joy and happiness. It's the same thing. I was just like, I'm responsible for the energy I bring into a room. I'm responsible for how I leave people. And I can't, you know, I can't control how people react to me, but I can control, like, am I bringing joy into a space? Am I giving people a platform to be open? And for me, the only way I could do that was to be honest with myself about how I was feeling, and to be, you know, honest and authentic with people about their own emotions and feelings. So, yeah.
Sure. Yeah, I'm blown away by the story. And I just, you know, having known you before as well, before you'd written the book, and having known your story a little bit, it's quite harrowing to read it in your own language. But not, by no means is this a hard, horrible, heavy book. It's it's happy and it's uplifting, and it's exactly what I think you intended it to be, which is inspiring to people.
Oh, good. That makes me really happy.
Do you go around and talk to people about this story of yours and give them some ideas?
Absolutely.
Give them some tips.
Yeah. So I have somehow managed to like live a career, if that makes any sense.
Sure.
But live a career in where I help people overcome their own trauma, you know. So like, for example, I was in Australia a couple of months ago, and I'd worked with this organization. It's a mentorship program, and they were teaching the forgiveness thing that I'd documented for them to kids who were transitioning. And they surprised me when I got there with like all these kids' stories about like how this, like my story had allowed them to forgive their dad, their mom, you know, someone who'd abused them, sexually molested them, all these things. And they made it into this beautiful montage where they all wrote me a letter and they read it out on camera. And I think it's moments like that where I'm like, oh, you know, like, wow. I'm so glad that this is, you know, helping someone. Mm. You know, that from my pain, someone else can also heal, you know.
Well, the book is called Forgiveness Redefined, and Candace Mama wrote it, and she's going to tell you the story, but you've got to go and buy the book.
Thank
you. She's
not
coming to just speak to you for free. buy the book. She went to a lot of trouble to write this, and the least you could do is go and buy a copy for that sake, right?
For me, I think the happiest thing, from this whole interview, is the fact that you told people it's not depressing.
No, it's not depressing.
Because I think a lot of people, like people will write to me and say, I cried. And then like people are like, I can't read your book. Like, I love you. I want to support you, but I don't want to be depressed.
And Candace, you've got a story. Like, it's a real story. Some people who have written books, you think, well, what have you ever really experienced? And this is a great journey. So it's beautiful. Well done.
Thank you, Gareth. I really appreciate it.
And it's good to see you again.
It's so good to see you. Yeah, and thank you so much.
I mean, see us some more.
Oh my gosh, this is like my home. Like, I miss it.
Like, there's still some of your stuff lying around here.
I want to steal that new little gadget there.
Yeah, all right. Yeah, go and get your stuff. It's probably in one of the boxes here. I'm looking at it. It's like a pair of boots. I think there's an old bra there as well. Is that not yours?
You know, I always knew I'd come back.
All right, well done on the book. It is called Forgiveness Redefined. Okay, it's time for Decrypto Season 2. We're already on to Episode 2. You want to know what's happening in the world of cryptocurrencies? You're in luck, because Luno and Cliff Central have decided to give you a practical guide to everything you need to know in the world of cryptocurrencies. You may know a lot about Bitcoin and cryptocurrencies, and if you've been following this podcast, you'd certainly have heard about Luno, the app-based crypto exchange that's helping to revolutionize money, but there is a lot more to it than that. We're at Luno headquarters in Cape Town, where Luno's GM, Marius Reitz, took some time out to tell us more about what it is that Luno does.
So Luno was founded in 2013 in South Africa. We've since grown to a team of 320 people across three continents. We have offices in seven countries, but we currently have our global head office based in London. And we have a team of 25, 30 people based there. And we recently opened our African head office based in Johannesburg. Our vision is to upgrade the world to a better financial system. We think that people will use Bitcoin in their everyday lives just like they're using money right now. There's a long laundry list of things that we believe money can become better at. And interesting enough, we're seeing agreement between banks, fintechs, regulators, and other people in the industry as to what that better future should look like. But we were seeing some disagreement still at this stage is how to reach that future state of frictionless money. So you have different companies like Amazon, companies like Facebook, who recently announced the Libra coin, and also challenger banks, all believing in this new, better future, but having different strategies as to how they want to achieve it or what their end vision is. So we've chosen decentralized cryptocurrency as a software or as an operating system that we believe will be able to upgrade the financial system to something that's optimized and something that's better. And we think that will come through a paradigm shift, something that comes from the left field, from a fintech perspective. Fintech typically only makes the user experience slightly better, or it makes payments slightly cheaper, but there's still a cost and there's still a delay in transaction. What we're saying is payments should be free, and payments should be instant, and should be completely frictionless. So money has evolved over thousands of years and continues to change. We are building a platform for people to access the future of money. So what we're doing right now at this stage is we're building a safe to use and easy to use platform that makes it possible for people to buy and sell and learn and also store cryptocurrencies for the first time. One of the gravest mistakes we made as an industry a year or two ago was to just assume that everyone understands Bitcoin and cryptocurrency, and especially in the 2017 Bitcoin run when the price, I think, reached a high of $20,000. people bought cryptocurrency because of the greed factor, and now it's our responsibility as a cryptocurrency player to educate the market on what cryptocurrency is and what the risks are. We're doing a lot of educational content on major SA publications. We're hosting monthly, quarterly meetups at our offices. We're busy with a university education tour. We hosted a meetup at Wits University. More education, I think, is extremely important, and it's not only the responsibility of Luno, for example. It's all the platforms and all the players in the industry, because the education element is still extremely important, specifically across the rest of Africa.
Decrypto is everything you need to know about buying, trading, and spending cryptocurrency. Brought to you by Luno, only on cliffcentral.com.
Cliffcentral.com.